fucking fruity. I'm Taylor.
And I actually do want horny robots running around up in here. Jemmy. And this is the Final Girl Files. This week, we watched 2005's The Devil's Rejects, directed by Rob Zombie, starring Sid Haig, Sherry Moon Zombie, the love of my life, and Bill Moseley. And we are not here to discuss it alone. Guest, would you introduce yourself, please?
Hi, I don't approve of chicken fucking. I'm Elle, and I'm back here again. Back at it for more.
So yay! Excited. Yay! We're happy to have you back.
I'm so happy that you
especially to talk about this movie, which is perhaps the most, like, you-coded movie in existence.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it really is. It was for me. Every movie he makes is for me.
We start with trigger warnings now, and there's going to be a lot of those in this one.
Yep.
Sexual
buckle
assault,
in, folks.
Huge, huge trigger warning for sexual assault in this movie. Real big. Also, necrophilia implied, also kind of seen. Just, like, general, like, if you know Rob Zombie movies, like, yeah.
We're throwing slurs around. We're not being nice to anybody. Like, we're not. Rob Zombie is. But, like, we're throwing slurs around. No.
Also, if you're sapphic, Sherry Moon Zombie in this movie will kill you.
Yes.
Yeah, it's true. It's very true.
But, yeah, violence, sexual assault. It's not a pleasant time in this movie for anyone but the Fireflies.
Yeah, I would also say discussions of bestiality.
Yes,
maybe
discussions of bestiality. No reason. Discussions of, like, sex work and all that good stuff.
Mm.
It's a Rob Zombie movie. What can I say? I can't even, like, list everything.
It's yucky, yucky, yucky. This
it's
film.
It's nasty.
It really is.
Elle, you are our guest, so I will ask you first. What are your memories with this movie?
Oh, thank you. I have quite the history with this movie. I first watched it in 2018. At the time, and this was such an experience, I hadn't heard of Rob Zombie previously, like, at all. I didn't listen to his music. I didn't know who he was. I didn't know anything about him prior to seeing this movie. And I also watched it the exact same night I watched House of Thousand Corpses. Like, I watched them back to back, which was an experience.
Can I just say, we met in 2017. It's kind of insane to me that I knew you during a period of your life where you didn't know about Rob Zombie.
Right? Literally, it's crazy. That was the thing. Like, you know, when we first met, I just started to get into horror, and I still was like, I kind of thought of myself as a little baby, and I thought that, you know, I didn't realize I was a sicko yet, so I didn't know what I could handle. So the things I knew about this movie prior to actually watching it were, I had seen part of the trailer because I was randomly scrolling on, like, Amazon Prime once, and I saw, like, a little clip of the trailer as I was going through, and I was like, that could be interesting. And then I also saw randomly the DVD cover for House of Thousand Corpses. And I thought that was the coolest shit I'd ever seen in my life. So I went to our group chat, Jemmy, that we had and have for Saw fans initially, mm-hmm. and just general horror people, and I was like, guys, what's the tea on Rob Zombie? Any of you guys fans, like, what's the tea? And our mutual friend of the pod, Calm, was like, you need to watch his stuff right now. It is so for you. You will die. So we watched House of Thousand.
She was right.
Yeah, it was so. It was like the most, like, we'd known each other for like maybe a year at that point, and she just got it like dead on. We watched House of Thousand Corpses, and I immediately fell so much in love with it that I was like, we have to watch the second one right now. And then we did. We watched Devil's Rejects. And then we also just watched, like, a shitload of his music videos. And it's just, you know, when you have an instant, not even just I like this movie, but you know when you have an instant, this director is for me. Like, this director gets me. Like, mm-hmm. It was that moment. I loved House of Thousand Corpses. And initially I was kind of lukewarm on Devil's Rejects because it's so different. And after just seeing House of Thousand Corpses, like, blind, I wasn't expecting it to be the way that it was. But then I just couldn't stop thinking about it for, like, years after that. Fast forward to, like, 2 years later, I'm in uni, I'm studying early modern lit, and I do a, you know, like, kind of month-long course specifically on revenge tragedies, and suddenly it just clicks. And I get it. And I understand why this movie has made me insane. And then I kind of went feral about it and wrote part of my undergrad dissertation on it, and now it's now. And I still haven't stopped thinking about it And I don't think I ever will. Yeah.
As you should.
100%. That's really funny. I also watched House of a Thousand Corpses with Carm for the first time.
She's just out there doing like the Lord's work, i.e.
she really is. Zombie
propaganda.
She's out there proselytizing.
Yeah. And that's what I do now. I've shown like his movies to everyone I know now. It's so funny.
Taylor, do you want to go next? Because mine's really boring.
Yeah. So the circumstances upon which I first watched The Devil's Rejects was I was working a job that I hated. Everyone who is friends with me remembers that job, the terrible job I had a few years back. And I was just watching a lot of movies because when I am not having a good time in my life, I tend to just like flop into consuming new media because it's a way that I like to take my brain off of things. It's like, well, if I spend my time analyzing a movie, I won't have time to think about how not fun I'm having in real life, which is kind of sad, but it did lead me to watching over the course of literally like 3 days in a row, like day one, House of a Thousand Corpses, day two, Devil's Rejects, day three, Three from Hell.
Oh, slay.
It was like, yeah.
Insane.
Amazing.
And it was just like a boom, 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 like a triple slam of all of these movies. And I was just like, this is now my entire personality. And it was for about 6 months.
And I love that for you.
And if anyone was friends with me during this period, I'm sorry.
No, do not be sorry. It was
because it was all I talked about and all I thought about. This murder family took up so much goddamn rent space in my mind. Mm-hmm. And they weren't paying a cent of rent for it. They were living rent free. And God, I loved them so much. And I still do. And this movie, I feel very affectionately about it because it is so like, oh, you got me through a rough period, which is a strange thing to say about a movie like this. But
holding up that "Your Music Saved Me" sign in front of the Firefly house.
Literally! Literally! Unfortunately, that is the truth. Like, God, I just fucking love this movie. Like,
same.
It's truly so important to me. Not just for, I guess it's strange to say that nostalgic about something that was like 2 years ago, but like, you know, for like remembering the good times we had together.
Yeah.
But just because it's based and it rules and it's a great film. And I love it.
It does slay.
And it's on Tubi.
It is on Tubi.
Amazing.
I think aren't all three of the Firefly movies on
Three
Tubi?
Three from Hell actually is not on Tubi. It's a Shudder original.
My story with this movie is really boring. I just watched it with Taylor and Elle one day. That's it.
Well, yeah, because it was after we did House of a Thousand Corpses on the pod, and you had said that you hadn't seen the other two.
Yeah.
And
yes.
Me and Eleanor were like, well, now we gotta watch the other two.
Yeah.
And so I did, and they slayed, and they're great.
Do slay.
I think the funny like difference here is that you guys both are like in it with this movie, and like I like this movie, but I'm also not a sicko, really. But I do like it. So it hasn't like rewritten my brain or anything, but it is a movie that I enjoy and that I like to, and that I would like, not that I necessarily reach for, but that I enjoy watching when it is suggested.
No,
so I
think
that's a funny like contrast going on here.
It's the difference between like a good movie and just a movie that is for you, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. Like this isn't for me, but it's a good movie and I enjoy it anyway.
This movie is very for me and Eleanor.
Yeah, it is.
It is.
It was made for us for like different reasons that overlap. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. Yeah. And I'm very excited to talk about those reasons today.
Oh, same. I'm so excited.
Like, I'm the Snow White of sickos. Like, I start singing in the middle of a meadow and all the sickos come out to frolic because they love me so much.
That's a really dead on comparison. Yeah. You are the sicko Snow White.
You just attract us.
You know that Tumblr post? It's like, how do I communicate to wild bunnies that I am their ally? I'm out here like, how do I communicate to wild sickos that I am their ally? Like, all I write and think about is like soft things, but also I love you guys so much, and I love the things you do.
Yeah, it's so funny because the first time, like the first thing that made me really want to be friends with you is when I saw you defending the carousel trap from Saw 6 on Tumblr, and I was like, oh, same.
Okay, but the carousel trap slaps.
It's the best one. I'll die on that hill. But we're not here to discuss that, so. later date.
It's the second best because the reverse bear trap is so iconic. Anyway.
Yeah.
Anyway, we're not talking about Saw, although I think we... There are some, like, comparisons between this movie and Saw. Eleanor actually wrote... You wrote about Saw and this movie for your dissertation, right?
Yeah, I my first chapter was on Saw and a movie called The Revenge's Tragedy, probably by Thomas Middleton, we don't really know. And then my second chapter was on Devil's Rejects and Shakespeare's play Titus Andronicus. And it was so slay. I love doing it so much.
And do you think Sheriff Weidel has what Mark Hoffman wants?
Oh my god, so true. Yeah, completely.
I should probably talk about, we probably should give a plot before we head up to the...
yes.
Let's see what Google has to say about what the plot of Devil's Rejects is. Because we've had some real weird plot descriptions these past couple of episodes.
Yeah.
Yeah, sometimes things that are just like flagrantly not wrong. The plot.
Yeah.
No, this one looks pretty normal. After a raid on the rural home of the Firefly family, I'm going to struggle saying Firefly family this whole time.
That is a tongue twister.
I can't talk. Two members of the clan, Otis and Baby, manage to flee the scene. Headed to a remote desert resort, the killers reunite with Baby's father, Captain Spaulding, who is equally demented and intent on maintaining their murder spree. While the trio continues to torment and kill various victims, the vengeful Sheriff Weidel, who has what Mark Hoffman wants, slowly closes in on them. That's pretty normal. I'll give that to Google. That's pretty normal.
That's the plot.
That is the plot of this movie.
I would like to start off our discussion by saying that my thoughts on this entire movie are just that I need more media with, like, horrible people that also have, like, genuine loved ones.
Please. Mm. Yeah.
I love a murder family.
Same so much. Literally, like, what Rob Zombie, I think, does better than any other director, and I will die on this hill, is he cares so deeply about every single one of his characters, no matter who they are. Like, whether they're the main character, whether they're, like, minor people who come on for one scene, they are all human, they are all real, they are all flawed. No one is one-dimensional, and I love it so much.
He and Guillermo del Toro, I think, have that in common.
Yeah, true. So true.
Because I know Guillermo del Toro is out here writing, like, OC biographies for all of his characters.
Yeah.
And I would not be surprised if Rob Zombie had, like, a similar, not process, but mindset to that.
Definitely. One thing I've always loved is, like, you know when characters die in Rob Zombie movies, typically, like, they'll have a little, like, flashback to, like, happy times with their loved ones. And I love that because it's, like, such a good, you know, device. It's, like, such a good way to, like, trigger empathy in your audience. But also I love that everyone gets it. Like, the victims in House of Thousand Corpses get it. The Fireflies get it. Like, random people. I love that he does that.
Yeah, it's really cool.
The Fireflies get it despite not actually dying at the end of this movie.
Yeah. It was so fucking funny. It was like, when I was watching this movie in preparation for this, we got to the ending and I was like, wow, they really did just survive that.
Can I just say really quickly,
like,
this is a sidebar.
Like a full Bonnie and Clyde situation, and it's like, and then the next movie is just like, and they lived. It's fine.
And they lived because Rob Zombie is not letting these fuckers go, and he's valid for that.
He is valid for that. I also wouldn't want to let them go.
Honestly.
I have to say, this is a sidebar, but I don't know if any of our listeners are familiar with Church of the Rock that does those weird fucking Easter plays. But the post-crucifixion lament this
year
was
preferred.
And it killed me. I could not think of anything but the end of this movie. Like, fucking Freebird starts playing and I'm just like, oh my god.
Right, that is the most evil thing you've ever said because you're so right and I hate it.
Oh, it's so bad.
Yeah, that's so really sometimes I'll be in, like, a public place. Cause, like, you know, Freebird is one of those songs that is, like, that's on that Walgreens playlist, you know, that's on that fucking, like, if you're in, like, a store and they have, like, a classic rock playlist going, Freebird is probably gonna come on at some point.
That's crazy.
I've been in so many goddamn situations where I'm in public, sometimes I'm at work, Freebird will just come on and I'll be like, cool. I have to be normal.
You have to stay there and pretend to be normal.
That's insane. We just get, like, Taylor Swift. What's going on over there? Like,
listen, it's very conservative on Long Island, and conservative people love classic rock for some reason.
Fair enough.
Rob Zombie, who is very much not conservative.
Yeah, and we will get into that later. I have so many notes on that. But, like, speaking about being emo for the Fireflies, I watched the director's commentary, and there were a couple of things that Rob said that really made me, like, emotional, so I would like to
Oh, please, do tell.
Tell them to you now. He mentioned really early on, and I'd never thought about this, like, when after the gunfight, Baby and her mom never see each other again. Like, that's really upsetting. That really upsetting.
Hey, I don't like that.
No. Because she just dies, and they never see each other again. And that really upset me. He also said that at the end of the movie, when the house is on fire, Tiny, like, walks back into it because he's realized that there's no way out of it, and he doesn't want to be alone. Which is just really upsetting.
Oh. Hey, I hate that.
Yeah. He also talked a lot about, like, the power struggle between Otis and Spaulding throughout this movie, and he said that apparently the reason he had Otis give Spaulding the biggest gun during the Freebird scene is because, like, that was a symbolic, like, handing over of power to you, like, I'm gonna give you the better gun, the better chance of surviving. It really, it got to me a lot watching the commentary. I love them so much.
God, that, it's so funny that you say that about, the scene where Tiny goes back into the house at the end of the movie, because it's one of those things where, like, I've never really quite understood it. It always kind of felt nonsensical to me. It's like, well, why can't you just get in the car with them?
But I think I had the quote somewhere. He knows he'll never see them again and he doesn't want to live alone. Like, that really upset him. That really broke him up.
Hey, that sucks.
Yeah.
Wow, Rob, way to take the one thing about the movie that I thought was kind of and then make it no, actually it slays.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sad now.
Yeah, but it's fine. It's fine. Well, it's not fine for Tiny, but, you know, Three from Hell exists. They're fine.
Three from Hell exists. It sure
They're doing
does.
Good.
They're fine. Never
They're
mind.
They're thriving at the end of Three from Hell, so.
Good for them.
They are. It is really funny watching this movie after you've seen Three from Hell, though, and just being like, where the fuck was Foxy during it?
I know.
Where was he? He just didn't give a shit.
He didn't care enough.
Yeah.
He didn't care enough.
Is he trying to be the Midnight Wolfman?
Oh, not the Midnight Wolfman.
I love it so much.
I love this movie because, well, for many reasons. But one reason that I really, really have such a strong affection for this movie is because I'm so deeply fascinated by Rob Zombie's ability to take characters who do some of the most horrific shit that I have ever seen characters do in horror movies and pull no punches with showing all of it and still make you love them so goddamn much. And it's not even just a, like, oh, I'm a sicko thing, because I've spoken to non-sickos who Jemmy is one of them.
I was going to say, me, primo non-sicko.
Non-sickos who, like, it's just something about the way that, like, Eleanor was talking about, like, there's just so much empathy for every character. An empathy which is not reserved for the sheriff.
Yes, exactly. Literally, like, I love how every single character in this movie gets a humanizing moment. Like, everyone, the random fucking cops that Wydell works with, get humanizing moments where they, like, talk about their lives and shit. Like, every person gets this moment where they, you know, get to be this flawed human, apart from the sheriff. Like, when he dies, there is no flashback to his loved ones. He just dies. You know, the closest he gets to it is the, like, kind of dream sequence with his dead brother, but even then, that's just part of his, like, you know, revenge quest, transformation into this, like, you know, depraved person that he becomes. It's not meant to be like a you feel sorry for him moment, and I just think that is so interesting because he should be, you know, the symbolic, you know, like the ultimate kind of representation of the law and, you know, what's good. In a normal movie he would be, but he's not in this, and I just think that is so telling of, you know, Rob's own views and where his sympathies lie, you know.
It's because Rob's an ACAB.
It's true.
This is the definition of an ACAB film. And it is funny because, like, with what Eleanor was talking about earlier with regards to, like having a humanizing moment, looking back on, like, times with your loved ones, it's almost like the narrative attempts to extend that to Sheriff Wydell, and he turns it down by turning that scene with his brother into an opportunity for him to be more disgusting and more just making the audience hate him more. It's like the movie is giving him a chance to redeem himself in the eyes of the audience, and he's like, no, I'm not going to do that. I suck, actually. And you should think I suck.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The one thing I thought was really interesting, and another thing I thought was really interesting about the commentary is, like, the one thing in this movie that sort of, other than that scene, edges close to, like, humanizing him is his weird thing about Elvis that he randomly has. And that was added by the actor. Like, that wasn't in the script that Rob wrote. Like, the actor just really likes Elvis. Like, so.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it was so funny.
That guy is the unsung MVP of this film. Like, he's he does so not get good. Enough credit for how fucking good he is in this movie.
His performance
He's insane.
Yeah, he's amazing.
I really respect an actor who can just put their whole pussy into a role where you fucking hate this person.
Yeah, completely. But again, it's not like I hate him, like I hate Mark Hoffman, where I'm like, I want you gone from this franchise. Like, he's an interesting character and I actually enjoy watching him. I just also despise him, you know?
Mark Hoffman wants what this man has. That's just the bottom line of it.
Mark Hoffman wants what this guy has, and also what Russell Crowe in Unhinged has.
Yes. So true.
And by that, of course, I mean like a good actor playing him.
Yeah.
Like,
Yeah.
Someone who's someone who has like charisma and is compelling on screen, you know.
Yeah.
This is an unrepentant anti-Costas Mandalore podcast, by the way.
Unrepentant. That guy fucking sucks. I'm not afraid to say it.
Nope.
I'm not afraid to say it because he's out here like posting anti-vax memes on Instagram. Fuck that guy.
It's really interesting as well because like Mark Hoffman does have almost exactly the same arc as Wydell. And yet he manages to make, like, my personal favorite arc, i.e., you know, the Revenger character becomes corrupted by their revenge and becomes as depraved as the person they're seeking revenge against, boring. He manages to make that suck, actually, and it's almost impressive.
God, I love a good old becoming what you hate arc.
Oh, it's so good.
And it is this strange, like, cross narrative throughout the Devil's Rejects where it's just like as the Firefly family becomes more and more nuanced and compelling and interesting and sympathetic in the eyes of the audience, Sheriff Wydell sinks further and further into depravity and hatred and bigotry and disgust and eliciting disgust.
Yeah, simultaneously while he is becoming worse, he is also invoking more and more like typical Christian iconography, which I think is so interesting. The whole Lord, I am your arm of justice bullshit that he keeps repeating to himself. I'm like, Rob Zombie said ACAB and Rob Zombie said Christianity sucks, and I respect that.
And he is so real and valid for that. The only Christians I respect are the Warrens.
Yeah.
The fictional Warrens, not even the real ones.
No, but not the fictional ones, the pretend ones. The real ones also sucked. But, you know.
I love the exchange that Wydell has with Mama Firefly in the jail, where like she I think it like clicks for her what's going on with him, and she's like, oh, you're dead already, like you you have completely and already like, you've already just like doomed yourself. My family's gonna fucking get you just because you are on this like horrible path and you're not turning back. You're dead already, like good luck, loser.
That was another thing that Rob said not in the commentary, but in an interview I read about this movie, was he wanted this whole movie to have a sense of tragedy in the sense that, you know, everyone is doomed. Like, the Fireflies are doomed, Wydell is doomed, there is nothing hopeful.
The Fireflies are, like, kind of doomed.
Well, yeah, I mean, at the time,
yeah,
we didn't intend to make more of these, but as we know, they are very much just fine after this, but, you know. It's so funny, like, in all
and, like, normally I would be like, man, Rob, how could you pull your punches here and bring them back, but I'm like, no, this is good, he can bring them back, he's allowed, this
is
fine.
He's allowed. It's like, on the one hand, I absolutely respect like a miserable, bleak, tragic ending that is sad. On the other hand, I also like when you give your beloved characters like a happy ending after putting them through hell, so, you know, I get it. I just get it. I understand.
Anything Rob Zombie does is valid, actually.
So true.
It's so real. Okay, we need to have a minute. Uh-huh. Just a minute.
Oh, are we having a horny minute?
Yes, we are three gay women talking about this film. Guys, Sherry Moon Zombie, let's talk about it.
Oh my god, her with that fucking hunting knife.
Yeah.
Eyeing up those two women on the bed. Yeah. Oh my god. Oh my god.
My god.
Thank you. Thank you, baby. I'm having a great time. Yeah. Thank you, baby. Oh my god.
The bit I can't remember her fucking name. The younger girl in the motel sequence when she tries to run away and they get her back in the room and Baby just starts like dry humping her on the bed. I was like, what are you doing, honey? Like, I know what you are.
I know what you are. Listen, any of her interactions with those two women are just like, I know what you are.
Yeah, literally. Like, she is
It's so funny because, like, Baby to me is like, she's somehow both gay but also like a female misogynist.
Yeah.
And I find it so funny.
These are mutually exclusive terms, Taylor. She can be both.
Yeah.
She fucks women. She also thinks that women are stupid and that she's the only smart woman. Yeah. Like, it's so funny. It's such a funny character. I love her.
She's the funniest character ever written.
Oh, God, I love her so much.
She's so important to me.
Those jeans that she wears. Yes.
Those jeans that she wears.
Those jeans that she wears. Baby.
We don't even need to say anything else. Just those jeans that she wears.
If you know one thing's going to happen in a Rob Zombie movie, you know it's going to be Sherry Moon Zombie is going to look really hot in some jeans.
Yeah.
And he's correct every... Like, listen, Rob Zombie uses his filmography to just be like, look how hot my wife is.
Yeah.
And yeah, Rob, you're right. That your wife is really hot, and I'm glad that you're sharing this with us.
Well, the thing, too, that cracks me up is, like, we talked a little bit about this in Lords of Salem, but, like, there is another female character, the younger of the two women in the motel, who is literally fully full frontal nude on screen for, like, a while, and... She is not framed sexually
way.
The camera, the way that she is shot, it's not sexualizing her. She just happened to have been grabbed out of the shower during that scene.
Mm-hmm.
She's naked, but it's not like you're supposed to find her hot in that scene.
If anything, it's just supposed to add to her like vulnerability in that moment.
Yes,
exactly.
Fully clothed Sherry Moon, on the other hand,
yeah.
The camera is horny for her.
Yeah,
I
respect it so deeply because it's not just like normal ass male gazy bullshit. It's just Rob being a wife guy.
Yeah.
And I love it for him.
Literally so powerful of him.
Good for you, Rob. Good for you, Rob.
If Sherry Moon Zombie was my wife, I would do the same.
Exactly. Exactly.
Anyway, that was our horny minute. I just needed to say, I just needed to put it out in the world. Sherry Moon Zombie, and Rob, if you're looking for a third, I'm available. I'm being both very hot.
Yeah.
My Twitter @ is @ Virgo Horror. Hit me up.
We're never going to get this man on our podcast.
DM me. No, we're not.
Him and ever. Patrick Wilson are never getting on this podcast.
Nope. Never ever. I'm dedicated to sexualizing these horror famous people, though. I will never rest.
As you should. Quite correctly.
Anyway, intellectual discussion.
Yes.
But speaking of that motel scene,
oh my God.
Truly one of the most, like, that in and of itself is a short film.
Yes, so true. So true.
Like, listen, I need to show that sequence specifically to everyone who doesn't think Rob Zombie is a filmmaker.
Oh my God.
Because, like,
so true.
The amount of film language and film knowledge that he uses to make that just like the most harrowing, disgusting scene is like, I don't think people realize how impressive that is. I feel like because of the content of Rob Zombie's movies, people are immediately willing to write him off as just like, oh, he's just doing his like nasty, disgusting thing, whatever the fuck. And like, no, you don't understand. It takes genuine skill and talent as a filmmaker to convey the things that he conveys with the camera and with the writing and with the characters. Like, I don't think people understand that it takes talent to make something that nasty.
One thing I really want to add to that as well is, like, that scene, I think, is the ultimate rebuttal to people who are like, we shouldn't ever show, like, sexual assault or anything of that nature in film because it's always, you know, male-gazy and just for, like, you know, sickos. Because I'm like, this is the ultimate non-male-gazy sexual assault scene. Like, it is so uncomfortable and upsetting and grim. Like, it is no one, like, you know. But the thing that I wanted to say about what he said on the commentary is that apparently that scene was so upsetting to film that, like, everyone on set was crying. Like, the crew was crying. Otis, I don't know why I said Otis, Bill Moseley apparently felt so bad during this.
Oh, no.
He literally, like, was finding it difficult to do. And there's this one anecdote they bring up that on the cast commentary, Sherry's, like, talking about filming the scene, and apparently, like, Rob had to pull Bill Moseley aside and be like, apparently what he said was, "Art is not safe," which I think is so funny as a phrase. But yeah, he actually had to pull him aside and be like, it's just art, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
He was so upset and he felt so bad. He also said that he didn't feel bad at all during the later scene where he kills two men. I think
one inspector Bill Moseley.
Hell yeah.
Literally so great.
Absolutely. Woman
respecter 3000 Bill Moseley.
I was crying when he said that.
Can I just say, funny. While we're on the subject of Bill Moseley, it has been a very weird weekend for me because the date last night I watched Devil's Rejects, and then the night before Taylor and I watched Repo.
Yes.
And I said this to her. I said this to her while I was watching it last night, and she was like, "You're right, but also I think Otis and Luigi are like kind of they're like opposite vibes, but kind of the same character." And I'm like, "Yeah, Luigi is what if Otis was in Succession, and Otis is what if Luigi was in Texas Chainsaw Massacre."
Yeah. So true. Oh, I love Luigi so much. That whole film is great.
My review of Repo, by the way, is I wish it was a movie I watched at 14 because I feel like it would have made me a different person.
Yeah. Yeah.
That motel sequence, good God. I don't think I have ever felt... It's one of those movies that is so hard to show people because of that scene.
Yeah.
Like, most movies that I enjoy, I generally have a pretty good sense of whether a friend of mine is going to be okay with the content in the film. But something about that scene is rough to watch in a way where even if I know a friend is, like, a sicko or is, like, okay with disturbing content in film, just how bleak that scene is. And I'm not even just talking about the sexual assault. I'm talking about even just like the tone throughout the scene.
Yeah.
Even before anything sexual happens. It's just so upsetting.
Yeah.
In a way where it's like, I don't know how comfortable I am telling a friend of mine, I love this movie.
Yeah, completely. Completely. There are only two movies I've had to like warn friends of mine about, like, before they saw them based on my recommendation, and it is this movie and the remake of Last House on the Left.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, both. Yeah, the Last House on the Left remake is also just like so fucking brutal from start to finish.
So upsetting. That scene is just it's so much. It's very so good. Hard to watch. It's very good, but it's a lot.
I definitely remember you guys giving me full and active warning throughout the entire like movie building up to that scene, and like the thing about me is that while I'm not a sicko, I can handle, like, sicko themes and stuff. Like, it feels weird to say I can handle that scene because it is very upsetting and very grim and very bleak. But, like, I can watch it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I do distinctly remember being aptly warned about this scene.
I also just remember when we watched it with you, it was like we were goofing throughout the movie, and then that scene happened and all three of us just dead silent.
Yeah,
like you cannot make jokes during that scene. It's hard to make jokes. Like maybe some like one of us made like some kind of awkward like trying to break the tension jokes, but like it's really hard to goof on that scene because it's so goddamn bleak. It's just hard. Mm-hmm. It's hard to watch. And I'm not surprising it was, or rather, I'm not surprised it was hard to film.
Mm-hmm.
Even for a director like Rob Zombie, who, by all accounts, runs a very kind and, you know, like, just like a nice set to be on. Like, there's some stuff filming that even the nicest and most pleasant directors who run a set really well can't make not hard to do. And
that's, you know, definitely one of them.
Yeah, kudos to all of the actors in that scene for like doing it as, like, even though it was hard to film, just putting their everything into it, because it, their talent really is reflected in, especially the actors playing the hostages.
Yeah.
Oh my god. Yeah.
Their reactions are so real.
Yeah, completely.
That's part of what makes it so difficult to watch, is that it feels so real.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think also it's just the contrast between their genuinely very harrowed, horrified reactions as things are happening to them versus the Fireflies' just joy.
Yeah.
they love to do this to people, and they will never get tired of fucking doing this shit to people.
Literally. That's like one of the two of the things that are amazing to me about this scene is, like, one, they don't have to do any of this. Like, in the moment, in the plot, they are just literally waiting for their fucking dad to arrive. They don't need to be doing any of this, but, you know, they see an opportunity and they just do it because that's who they are and that's what they like to do. And also, you have this scene, which is, like, so viscerally upsetting to watch. And then, like, maybe 10, 15 minutes later, you have the fucking ice cream scene, and suddenly you just love them again. It's so incredibly well done how he gets you to still care about these people, even after witnessing all of that. Like, it's, you know, shows the power of his writing, I think.
Absolutely.
The ice cream scene, too, I just love, because
Rob Zombie has definitely been on a road trip with his family.
Yeah. I always say this about the Fireflies whenever I watch this with anybody. But, like, good God, if you have siblings.
Yeah.
This, like, if you and your siblings were murderers, this is how you would talk to each other. Like, you know, like, it's so, like, listen, I'm a sicko. I understand the people who are out here shipping Baby and Otis. I get it.
Mm-hmm.
It's, they, to me, read as completely non, you know, like, they're just siblings. They're just siblings to me.
They're, like, fuck yous back and forth between them are such sibling energy.
I also love the Spalding baby Otis dynamic, because it's so, like, dad and favorite kid versus unfavorite kid. Like, it's so, like, dad who takes the favorite kid's side, and, like, the two of them, how much they love to needle Otis is just so funny to me. It's so good, and it makes me so, I mean, like, I love Foxy. I do.
I know.
Richard Brake also hit me up. But it's just, it makes me sad that we did not get to have Otis Baby and Spalding in Three from Hell together, because God, their dynamic in this movie is just delightful. It's so good. They love each other so goddamn much.
They really do. It's like, you know, you can't watch this movie and not love them by the end. And that's fucking amazing when you consider the things you see them do in the first half. Like, it's crazy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, again, it's that, like, it's like, in my head, I just picture a graph with, like, two lines that just cross at one point in the middle and just kind of, you know, it's like, again, just like, as they become more likable over the course of the film, the sheriff is becoming more unlikable, and it that is wild.
Yeah, it's insane. It's so well done.
I'm also interested in discussing the tone shift between this and House of a Thousand Corpses. I feel like it would be an error in judgment if we didn't at least touch on that. Because it is such a different film.
Yeah,
it's that at times it really doesn't even feel like a sequel.
Literally, my first note was about the shift in tone, because it's, I think Rob does a really good job. I like that we're calling him Rob. Like, our first name basis with this man.
Because he's our friend Rob.
Yeah, our friend Rob. I think it's really, like, I think he does a really good job right away of establishing that, like, this is going to be a completely different tone from House of a Thousand Corpses, because while House of a Thousand Corpses as a movie feels like going on, like, a Halloween carnival ride, this is very grim, very gritty, very real in a way that House of a Thousand Corpses is not.
Exactly. My pet theory about this is it's all due to 9/11, as you all know. because that's what half of my dissertation was about.
Was House of a Thousand Corpses pre 9/11?
Yes, so it was made.
It was filmed pre 9/11. It was released post 9/11 because of, you know, we got into the production troubles during our House of a Thousand Corpses episode. But
it
sat on a shelf for a few years. Mm. So it was filmed in, I believe, like 99 or 2000.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
So yeah.
I just, you know, not to like put on my stupid like academic hat for a second.
No, please put on your stupid academic hat.
Well, it's just this movie is so interesting when viewed as a post 9/11 piece of filmmaking, because you have, like, on the one hand, it is very much like pulling from 70s like exploitation grindhouse movies, and also pulling from westerns in the sense of like Bonnie and Clyde and a bunch of other movies I haven't seen, but I know about because Rob name drops them constantly. But the resonance it has with the immediate post 9/11 climate is so interesting. There's a really, really excellent essay by a woman called Linnie Blake I've forgotten the name of it. I think it's just called like Horror After 9/11. It's like a book of essays. And her entire argument is basically like part of the kind of propaganda that they use to, I don't know what the right word is here, to do the war on terror is like, the enemy want us to, you know, Americans stand for freedom and the enemy want us to stop being free, right? But if you look at, you know, American conservatism, it's the most like, you don't have any freedom. You have to be a certain way. You have to behave in a certain socially acceptable way.
I mean, it's right there in the name, conservative.
Like, exactly.
When you think of conserving something, it's like preserving something, keeping it the same way that it is all the time.
Yeah, completely. So then, you know, with these characters viewed through that lens, they are like ultimately the completely free. They are the embodiment of freedom, right? And by like kind of forcing you to consider them as people and having this really complicated relationship with like, who do you identify with in this movie? You're kind of urged to see the conflict from both sides and to reflect on like your own freedom and how, you know, the whole idea of America, land of the free, is just pure propaganda. Like, it is a complete fantasy. And I just love how in this article she views this entire movie as just a kind of alternative to like the narratives we tell ourselves about the way society works. I just find that so fascinating. And yeah, I also just think like it's not, this movie isn't torture porn really, but it, especially the motel scene, it shares so many themes and tropes with torture porn, and obviously torture porn entirely came out of being in the post 9/11 climate. With the focus on, you know, torture and what is acceptable, how far can you go to get revenge, and is that an acceptable thing to do? And you know, do the ends justify the means, which is the entire point of the sheriff's arc in this movie. Is, you know, by like at the start of the movie, you're like, okay, he is the sheriff, he is the embodiment of lawful morality. He has a sympathetic reason for wanting these people dead. And by the end, you love the Fireflies and hate him, and he dies completely unceremoniously.
I mean, you're right about all of it. Like,
yeah, 100%.
The whole thing that I find so fascinating about revenge stories like this is, especially when they came out of the post 9/11 era, is like a lot of, like, again, like American kind of propaganda and speeches around that time was like, we've got to get them back, you know. And this entire movie's thesis statement is like, revenge is futile. It doesn't help anybody. Like, the Fireflies can't change. They can't be made to repent. Like, Otis, like, mocks that whole idea during the I'm the devil and I'm here to do the devil's work speech. You know, his whole thing is, like, mocking the idea that he could ever be made to repent because these are the way that they are. Like, they don't have to do any of that in the motel. They just do it because that's who they are as people. So, like, the sheriff's revenge thing, you know, even after they've been tortured and experienced what's been done to, like, what they've done to others being done to themselves, it doesn't prompt a change of heart, and it doesn't, all his revenge quest does is hurt more people. It's very much a revenge is bad movie, and when taken with the, you know, limits of American freedom stuff I talked about earlier. That is just such a fascinating statement to make in the era immediately preceding? No, preceding is before.
Following.
Following 9/11. Anyway, I hope any of that made sense. I will get off my soapbox now.
That's fucking fascinating.
I love that article so much. He only like refers to it briefly, but there's a book by a guy named Aaron Kerner called, I think it's Torture Porn in the Wake of 9/11. All of these books have similar names. He has a whole chapter on Wrong Turn films, like not just the Wrong Turn films, but films that follow that template. And it's really good. He only briefly talks about Devil's Rejects because it's not really one of those, but he has similar views, and it's really good. Highly recommended. Slays. Fox and Bangs.
Yeah. The Firefly movies always sort of exist to me like adjacent to torture porn movies.
Mm.
And I think a lot of that probably has to do with the fact that the first one was done like before 9/11, like Taylor said, filmed before 9/11, and it has such a different tone, and some of that energy carries on over into the rest of the movies. So it's never quite full torture porn, but there's a lot of the same elements and tropes, yeah. And it definitely covers similar themes.
Definitely.
Yeah, this movie and the other Firefly movies, but especially this one, to me feels like torture porn's like like weird cousin.
Yeah.
Completely.
Like, there are some things in common. They're from the same family, but they're not the same thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. 31, too, is very weirdly torture porn-esque, which is so funny to me because it came out in 2016.
Yeah. Throwback.
Yeah, literally.
I will say, just quick shift, because I do want to bring this up, but, like, one thing that I could not stop thinking about while watching this film was that I love Rob Zombie's recent stuff. I do. Don't get it twisted, but this is a guy who needs a fucking budget to make a movie. And think the reason that his recent work has suffered so much critically is because he, as a filmmaker, is so ambitious in a way that requires him to have a certain amount of money backing him.
Yeah.
In just production, so that he can aesthetically, because his aesthetic eye is so key to his filmmaking style. And I think that that's the reason that something like The Munsters, which I did enjoy, but it suffered a lot for me from its lack of a budget. Because he had all these big ideas and he didn't have the money to really make them happen in the way that he wanted them to happen.
Completely.
And I love 31, but 31 has the same problem.
Yeah.
Lots of big ideas, did not have the money to make those big ideas happen.
The solution here is that we shovel money at Ron Zombie and let him do whatever the fuck he wants. Exactly. And then we get legs again.
This movie had been made immediately off of the back of House of 1,000 Corpses, which made a shit ton of fucking money.
Mm.
And so Lionsgate was like throwing money at Rob Zombie. And I think this is really the only Rob Zombie movie where you get to see him really shine in the way that he was meant to shine.
Yeah.
And again, that's not to disparage his other movies. I give Lords of Salem 4 stars. Like, I give, you know, like, all of his movies to me are 4-star films. But, God, this is a man who needs a budget.
Yeah, completely.
Like, 31 again was funded on a Kickstarter, and you can tell.
Yeah.
Because at times, it does not look great. And it's not because Rob Zombie is not talented. It's a budgetary limitation. And this film, having a ton of money behind it, really, really shines.
Mm-hmm.
He's really able to go in and be meticulous about, like, color and lighting and camera and getting the exact shots that he wants, how he wants them, and having enough time and... And that's my soapbox.
And you're so right.
This is our plea to every studio out there. Please, for the love of God, shovel money at Rob Zombie and he won't disappoint you.
Like, and this movie is not like a high budget film, by the way. But like, I just think that this man should be getting blockbuster money. Honestly. Like, he should be getting like, like Star Wars money, Marvel money. Like,
give that man Marvel money.
Give him Marvel money. My fucking God, let him make a blockbuster because he just would slay.
Yeah.
And the problem is that his content is so subversive that it just does not
attract
people who are willing to give him that kind of money. And it just...
All right, sickos, we need to rally together. We need to all go to the theaters for Rob's next movie.
We do.
I don't mean to be depressing, but it's really like the great tragedy of Rob Zombie's career is that he is too interesting for his own fucking good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, you guys both know I'm a Halloween 2 stan, and no film exemplifies that better than that one, I think, because that film is so hated when it is one of the most interesting films I've ever seen in my life. It has so many good ideas, and I will not apologize.
We need to bring you on to talk about Rob Zombie's Halloween 2. Oh,
I love that fucking movie.
I think you two are going to have to do that episode together, because I would be mean to that movie.
I think I would also be mean to that movie, no. But I think it would be a good contrast to have somebody who likes it and some, like, people who don't like it, just because, like...
Yeah, true.
That's true.
It would be like the Skinamarink episode. Yeah.
Get Rinked On.
Get Rinked On, idiots.
Get Rinked On part two.
I want to talk about the use of music in this movie briefly, because it makes me feel
crazy. Yes, God, yes.
That's a good topic to close out on, I think.
Yeah. It makes me insane. Because, like, first of all, it's just so good. The opening montage is... just one of the best things I've ever seen. It's so fucking good. But also the way he uses the songs very, very literally to underscore the themes in a way that doesn't feel cheesy is amazing to me. Because it's like, it all goes back to the shit I've been talking about this whole episode. Is like, obviously you have Freebird with the, you know, Lord knows I can't change lyrics. But there's also the scene... I tend to just think of it as the scene where you see baby in a bathtub, because that's all I'm focusing on. It's like just after the party scene, there's a Terry Reid song with the lyrics that start with like "We are what we are," and it just so underscores this idea, like I said, like his revenge is completely futile because they can't change, like they are just the way that they are, and I love how he manages to use the music to, like, you know, perfectly add to what is going on screen and, like, you know, make the mood work and the tone work, but also just, like, put the themes, like, front and center. Like, just in case you missed it, they can't change as Freebird plays, you know? I just love that. It's so good.
Freebird. Yeah, and I think it's so good because it really, to me... brings home this idea of, like, you know, people who are not marginalized often are like, why do queer people relate to villains so much?
Yeah.
Why do you relate to evil, murderous freaks? And it's just this idea of, like, we were born a certain way and we just kind of want to do the thing that we like to do. And yeah, it's fictional murder in the movie, but, you know, I don't know, there's a paper, like an academic paper in there somewhere that I'm sure somebody smarter than me has written about the affection that queer people often have for evil, villainous, marginalized people. And I think that Rob Zombie has a gift for tapping into that
completely.
Absolutely. Also, just to quickly call out my fucking college film program, fuck my queer cinema class for never showing us a single horror movie.
Yes.
Horror, the queerest genre of film. Fuck you. Fuck you for making me watch a million coming-of-age movies when I just wanted to sit down and watch Sleepaway Camp. Fuck you. Anyway.
So true.
But you're so right. Like queer cinema is inextricable from the evildoer. And I think that it has a lot to do with, like, oh, in the past, the only queer characters that were allowed to exist on film were evil people. And that culturally has kind of morphed into this affection that queer people often have for villains and, you know, the evildoer on screen.
Mm-hmm.
And all this to say, I just love the Fireflies, and I think that they should be allowed to do whatever they want. They're not real. They're not hurting real people. They're killing pretend people, and I think they should be allowed to keep killing pretend people.
Honestly, I think
they should be able to kill as many pretend people as they want.
Completely. I also think they should kill me, a real person, but like that's
I think that specifically Baby Firefly should get to kill you.
Yeah, please. Please.
Can she and kill also me too? Can I be second in line for that one? Oh, I'll be third in line. It's fine.
All three of us fucking lining up. She can do whatever she wants to me.
Anything.
Period.
I am ready, willing, and able. And I think that that's a great note to go out on.
100%.
For this discussion.
There's no other way it could end.
Do you guys want to read some Letterboxd reviews?
Oh, please. Yes.
So a lot of these were smart, so I had to find silly ones, silly goofy ones. But I do a segment on this podcast called Live Laugh Letterboxd, where I read funny Letterboxd reviews. And our first review comes, it's a baffling review from a user called PG187, who simply says, I like this because it reminds me of my dad. 5 stars.
Okay.
Lots to unpack there. We don't have enough time.
On the one hand, it's probably that your dad just enjoyed this movie, which, like, same. But also, was your dad a murderer? Maybe.
Inquiring minds want to know.
Maybe. Hosni, I think that's how you say their name, says, this isn't even a horror movie. Southern people just be like that. 3.5 stars.
Nice.
I'm nodding sagely. You can't see it.
A Scary Ghost, that is their username, which I love. Ooh,
love it.
Spooky. Says, what happened to Dr. Satan after the raid? I hope he is okay.
Oh my god. Right. There are deleted scenes with Dr. Satan in them, and Rob cut them because he thought they were too silly.
Which I love.
Like, it pisses me off to no end. I'm like, keep the stupid shit in, please. Anyway.
I want to see the dumb stuff, please, Rob. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
Kylie says, what we're all thinking watching this movie, if you're attracted to women, which is, Baby Firefly, please give me a chance. Pleading emoji, 2 hands holding out emoji.
Yeah.
4.5 stars.
Yep.
Roxy says, it's crazy to think that such a subversive film would come from Rob Zombie, the creator of an album called The Electric Warlock Acid Witch Satanic Orgy Celebration Dispenser. But he really did that.
I love Rob Zombie so much.
And I had forgotten that he made an album called that, but he did. That is the name of the album.
Wasn't the album slap? Yeah, wasn't that one of the recent ones? They've all had titles like that.
I think it's like 2017 or something that came out, which, like, slay. Okay. I love his music. I don't even really listen to metal, but, like, I love his music.
It's so good.
Oh, it's so good.
Azriel Susie Minicky, I think is how you say their name. Again, I'm very sorry if I ever say your name wrong on this segment. I don't know you. Just says, they had, like, a long review with a lot of bullet points, but I did want to pick out a few of my favorites.
Please.
One bullet point which says, this movie is going to murder me in my sleep.
True.
And then another one which says, why simply tweet about how much America sucks when you could, in fact, simply write and direct The Devil's Rejects instead?
So true.
Literally.
Rob is out here doing praxis, honestly.
Yeah, like he's doing more than a lot of Twitter socialists, hot take.
Honestly.
Correct.
When will you write and direct The Devil's Rejects, Twitter user at Karl Marx's penis? You know?
Truly.
There's probably someone on Twitter who has that at name that I just thought that I made up.
Pulled out, yeah.
It's not Twitter you. I don't care about penis. You. I'm just making fun of generally the silly goofiness of online leftism. But, like, you should be writing and directing movies like The Devil's Rejects, I think.
We all should.
And that is the final Letterboxd review that I have.
Thank you.
How many stars are you guys giving this film?
4, baby. It's not the movie that I would necessarily reach for if I'm looking to watch a movie. I am not a sicko, but I am a sicko's ally, and I enjoy it. So 4 stars.
As we say often on this podcast, we reserve a 5-star review for our all-timers. It like movies that are like, this is bonded to my soul. This is one of the films I love the most in the world. Like, so a 4-star review does not necessarily mean there was anything wrong with the film. Mm-hmm. Just means
exactly.
It's not an is for me movie.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's no Conjuring 2 for
exactly.
me.
Exactly. Yeah. 5-star reviews are reserved for the movies that are, like, bonded to you for life forever. That being said, I am going to be giving this 5 stars.
Yes.
Because this is a movie that is bonded to my soul forever. This is a Taylor film. I love this goddamn movie. I'll never get sick of watching it. I'll watch it 100 more fucking times, and I'll get something new out of it every time I do.
Literally. Yeah, my longest 5 stars ever. That didn't work.
Really, Elle, I didn't think, you know, it's really surprising, Elle. I thought you were going to give this a good old one-er.
Yeah. I'm not a fan. I don't like it that much.
It would really be really funny if out of nowhere at the end of this, you were like, I've decided to give up sicko's-ness, actually. This is a one-star film.
Yeah. Or just like, it was mid, 3 stars. Like,
this is Eleanor's announcement that she's converting to Christianity. I am. Born again. Oh, like, she's a child of God now. She hates sin and murder. Amen. And especially cannibalism hates it.
Yeah, not a fan. I watched The Devil's Rejects, the very famously like anti-Christian movie, and was like, yeah, I want to do that, actually. this time on my 10th rewatch, it finally hit that Rob is actually saying Christianity is good, actually.
You have to watch it 10 times to really get the beef.
You have to be a real intellectual to understand Rick and Morty, you know?
My IQ is very high. I watch Rick and Morty.
Fuck you for making the same reference I just made. Oh, God.
I love you.
Oh, I love you too, but God, at what cost? Oh, God. So, yeah, 1 star from you, Eleanor?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Half, actually. I've actually only given 3 movies half a star on Letterboxd, for real.
I'm so intrigued as to what they are.
They are. Let's see if I can remember them. Okay, one of them is, fuck me, I can't remember what it's called. Give me a second.
I feel like that does say a lot about you.
I have a lot of half a stars, mostly just because I watch a lot of shitty Tubi movies.
So, yeah, the 3 movies I've given half a star to are the first Fantastic Beasts, because I thought it sucked, and I didn't enjoy it. And this wasn't even, you know, after the J.K. Rowling. This was prior to J.K. Rowling being insane. I just thought it sucked. One of them is a movie called The Haunting of Sharon Tate, which is as bad as it sounds, because it's like, what if the Manson family murders happened, but Sharon Tate was psychic and saw it coming, and it is dog shit. Do not watch.
I've heard things about that movie, capital T.
So bad. It's not even, like, fun as, like, this is shit watch. It just sucks. The third one is a special case. It is Saw 3D, Saw 7, Saw the Final Chapter, because it personally offends me in several ways, namely by introducing like some of the coolest ideas in the entire franchise and then wasting them, and making me look at Mark Hoffman's face for most of the runtime.
And not making you look at Cary Elwes's face enough. He is not in that goddamn movie enough.
And the shit that happens to Jill, because it pisses me off and I will not ever.
I watched that scene once and I will never watch it again because it upset me so much.
Yeah. It's not even like the actual death scene that really upsets me. It's the fucking weird ass, like misogynistic like dream sequence that happens where she's like in a skimpy nightdress, like being held up by chains. It's bad. Anyway, I hate
with the most phallic trap you've ever seen.
Yeah.
It's terrible.
Fucking I can't even say I hate that movie, because I have, like, complicated feelings about it, but yeah, it's bad.
I can say it. I hate that movie.
I just...
Saw 7 is the horrors.
Saw 7 is the horrors. So true.
Anyway.
All right. Thankfully, we are not watching Saw 7 next week or next time.
Thank God.
Thank God. We will be watching 2018's Hereditary.
Ooh!
Good old Ari Aster. We're starting a block for May of... Shitty Moms.
Shitty Moms.
Oh, amazing. Base.
Shitty Moms after doing A Good Mother last year for May, my beautiful wife.
Slay.
Yes.
This will be the first time I'm watching Hereditary. I'm rewatching Hereditary since I saw it in theaters, so this will be fun.
Because it fucked you up so bad?
Yes.
Oh, God. Yeah, I feel the same. It really messed with me when I saw it, and I'm really excited to watch it again and experience the horrors again.
Yep. Slay.
So until then, you can follow us at FGF Pod on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok. And Elle, where can we find you?
I am at Cannibalism, as in cannibalism with an E instead of an A, on Twitter. And my Letterboxd is linked there, but I think it is at Coolest Cannibal, something like that. That's all the social media I have that I actually use. So,
and you're Yas and Slay for that. Yes. Those are the only two that you need.
Yeah, truly. I have Instagram, but I never use it, so it's not worth telling you about.
And if you enjoyed our show here today, you can give us those 5 stars on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, do whatever it is you need to do on your podcast platform of choice to let us know that you enjoyed what we did here today. And we will see you next time for Hereditary. Bye, guys.
Bye.
Bye.